Coming up on Tech News Today, U.S. torpedoes the World Telecom Treaty, Aereo gets a cable channel, and will English conquer the internet? All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, December 14th, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Lantronics, maker of the XPrint server. Print from your iPad, iPhone, or any iOS device to virtually any printer. For more information, visit xprintserver.com/twit and enter the code HOLIDAY2012 to receive 20% off on your order. And by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT12. And they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. Welcome to Tech News Today, live in Santa Monica, California. I'm Tom Merritt.
And live in Petaluma, I'm Aya Zaktar.
I'm still alive, Darren Kitchen.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we put together the best stories in the tech world. We got Shannon Morse joining us, too, in a few minutes. Let's start with the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Eighty-nine of the 193 member countries of the International Telecommunications Union signed a new treaty on world telecommunications regulation Friday. The U.S. and Canada led a number of countries who refused to sign based on the inclusion of language about the internet. While none of the language was binding, the U.S. does not believe the treaty should reference the internet in any way.
Seattle is building out its own gigabit broadband network by partnering up with Gigabit Squared. The network has three components: a mobile broadband service, point-to-point wireless, and fiber to the home that will reach 50,000 homes. Gigabit Squared is currently raising the funding necessary for the project and to build out a demonstration fiber network.
Sprint's asking their mom, SoftBank, for more money so they can buy Clearwire, but mom's like, dude, I ain't made of money. Sprint offered Clearwire $2.1 billion, which would be $2.90 a share. Clearwire shareholders want more, and Reuters reports that SoftBank will only authorize Sprint to pay up to $2.97 each. Clearwire shares have actually shot up to $3 since the news.
Apple's share price has been a bit of a puzzle lately, with pretty much everyone on the street espousing a theory as to why. Some people think it's declining market share. Other people say, oh, it's a lack of vision. Analysts at Stern AG say, get used to it. They expect volatility in the stock until at least the end of the year, mostly because investors want to get some value out of that high-priced stock in case the U.S. does get pushed into recession by its idiot politicians on both sides of the aisle. iPhone sales are expected to be profitable, though, so good news there.
Our long national nightmare is over. Google has introduced a new way to stop accidental clicking of mobile ads by introducing confirmed clicks. If you click the outer edge of a banner ad, you'll see a prompt where you'll have to click again to see the ad. Text-based ads will feature a blue button with a white arrow. Clicking that button will take you to the ad. Clicking anywhere other than that space will expand the button to show you text that says visit the site.
Co-founder and former CTO of PayPal, Max Levchin, is the newest person on Yahoo's board of directors. On his personal blog, Levchin explained the three reasons he accepted. First, he's got a soft spot for Yahoo. Two, on a business side, a stronger Yahoo is better for Silicon Valley and the United States. And three, balls. He said that Mercer Meyer's move to take the top role at Yahoo was, quote, a very ballsy move, and he's excited to work with her. Bringing the balls.
Ballsy of him to say so. The United States Trade Representative's New Year's gift to the world is an out-of-cycle review of notorious markets, which identifies markets engaged in substantial piracy and counterfeiting. The Pirate Bay, as usual, tops the charts, followed now by ISO Hunt. Gone from the list is China's Taobao e-commerce site, owned by Alibaba Group Holding, who has, quote, undertaken notable efforts to work with rights holders.
Google's Copyright Transparency Report has a new feature. It will now show false DMC takedown requests. You'd have to look at a specific takedown request to see the false requests. They're listed under the, quote, no action taken section. Sometimes requests are under the no action designation because the infringing content has already been taken down. However, there are times when there's no infringement. The Google Transparency Report FAQ recounts the case of a movie studio requesting to remove an official trailer from an authorized service.
Microsoft's investigating an alleged flaw in Internet Explorer exposed by Spider.io security. Now, the exploit works through any display ad in all versions of IE and tracks mouse movements even if the page displaying the ad isn't active or even minimized. Microsoft describes the possible vulnerability as likely having to do with, quote, competition between analysis companies.
Pentagon hacker Gary McKinnon will not be prosecuted in the UK, according to the Crown Prosecution Service. The decision comes after his extradition to the US was blocked for health reasons. McKinnon has offered a signed confession to the UK, but the government has consistently declined to prosecute. This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Lantronics, XPrint server, enabling your wireless printing from your iPad, your iPod Touch, your iPhone, any iOS device, and you don't need to go through an app to do it. It's not like you hook up a printer and then you got to install an app, and then anytime you want to print something, you got to email yourself the document. It's easy. You plug in the Lantronics to your network, and if you've got a USB printer, you're like, oh, I don't have a network printer. Your printer becomes a network printer because you plug that USB printer into the Lantronics and boom, you've got yourself a wired or wireless networked printer. Print directly from the iOS native menu. No apps to buy or software to load. Supports more than 4,000 of the top brand network printers, so your printer is likely to work. And it's so easy to use. Automatic discovery and setup of printers, which I know sounds like a pie in the sky. People say that all the time, and then you actually try to set it up, and it's not as easy as they say. I opened mine up, I plugged it in, and it printed. Advanced configuration is available via web interface if you need it. And one XPrint server supports multiple printers. You can get a home edition for $99. That gives you 8 USB printers and 2 network printers. Or an office edition for $199. That supports up to 8 USB and an unlimited network printers. And like I said, USB printers become network printers. So go check it out. XPrintServer.com/twit for more information and to buy. And we've got a special offer for the month of December. Use the code HOLIDAY2012 to receive 20% off on your order. Remember, visit XPrintServer.com/twit. And at checkout, enter the code HOLIDAY2012. We thank Lantronics for their support of Tech News Today. Well, you kind of got a sneak peek at her when we started the show. If you're watching in video, Shannon Morse from hack5.org joining us this morning. Thanks, Shannon.
Hi, how are you?
We got a full house over there because your co-host, Mr. Darren Kitchen, as usual, is back with us on Friday as well.
Hey!
Hey, what's going on, man?
I've seen you.
I think I saw you yesterday, maybe?
On ThreatWire.
ThreatWire, that's right. That's where I saw
you. You know what we were talking about on ThreatWire like for the last couple of weeks, Tom? We've been talking about the ITU.
Have you been talking about how the UN's game-changing internet treaty failed? Because that just happened.
Yeah.
World Conference of International Telecommunications going on, as Darren mentioned, for 2 weeks now. And Ambassador Terry Kramer of the United States said yesterday, it's with a heavy heart and a sense of missed opportunities that the United States must communicate that it's not able to sign the agreement in the current form. 89 states of the 193 member states did sign the form today. 55 did not sign the treaty. I know those numbers don't add up, but there's some other reasons why other nations aren't counted there. Mohammed Al-Khanim said to the 89 states that signed, thank you. ITU Secretary General Dr. Hamadoun Touré said he's puzzled, indicating the treaty language specifically did not address content-related communication, fought spam, and promoted universal access and security. So, what's the problem? What is it that the U.S. and Canada are all up in arms about? There was no taking away the domain name system from ICANN. There was none of this. You know, the U.N. is now going to regulate the Internet. Here's what's in the treaty. You guys tell me what you think is the objection here.
I don't see how you can say, this isn't about content. Oh, but it's also about spam, because spam is one of those things. It's like, how do you define it? You know,
let me read the passages.
All right, go ahead.
Member states affirm their commitment to implement these regulations in a manner that respects and upholds their human rights obligations. That was so far so good. Here's one of the offending passages. A non-binding resolution stated that the ITU would, quote, continue to take the necessary steps for ITU to play an active and constructive role in the development of broadband and multi-stakeholder model of the Internet. Does that bug you, Darren?
It's kind of vague. You know, I mean, it begs the question, are you talking about infrastructure here?
It's very vague. What do they mean when they say multi-stakeholder model of the Internet?
Well, In other words, more than just the United States or more than just ICANN. And there's governments, there's not NGOs, there's peoples, that everybody should be involved in the governing of the Internet.
Right, and historically, the internet spawned out of a Department of Defense project, and it's been very U.S.-centric, and it becomes more and more global, and you've seen the pushback from Russia, China, Algeria, Saudi Arabia, all proposing, for example, one of their recommendations was for to take over the internet numbering name and address identification resources and turn that into a U.N.-controlled resource. Of course, that was eventually shelved. But right now, ICANN is a nonprofit organization, I believe, here in California. So it is a bit U.S.-centric. I can understand why some might say, like, hey, let's make this a little bit more open. But then
here's the thing. The ITU treaty doesn't say anything about regulating the internet. It does say all governments should have an equal role and responsibility for international internet governance and for ensuring the stability, security, and continuity of the existing internet. So talking about cybersecurity there. It doesn't change anything. It just says they should. Member states should endeavor to take necessary measures to prevent the propagation of unsolicited bulk electronic communications. That's talking about spam. That's also talking about cold calls, robocalls. And then the African bloc got an addition to the preamble of the treaty, approved by a 77-33 vote. These regulations recognize the right of access of member states to international telecommunication services. What's wrong with any of this? This all sounds perfectly reasonable. Ayaz, do you see issues with this?
Yeah, I mean, flat out, it's ceding any control by any of the controllers of the internet. It just seems like it would be a problem for the big countries, right? The U.S. They don't want to have anything to do with this. The other weird thing is, the human rights aspect of the internet, like that seems like it just snuck in. That seems to have nothing to really do with regulation of the internet so much as stopping it from. Well, I mean, how could that exist with regulation at the same time?
The thing is, it sounds good. In fact, this has already been agreed upon by different UN organizations. I think it was like ECOSOC or something that decided that access to the internet was a basic human right, and that was like 2 years ago. So, yes, that's a warm fuzzy. I think that a lot of this, is very vague and doesn't actually have a lot of it seems very hollow. I mean, given that half the,
But that's the idea, right? That's what the ITU is saying is, we didn't enact anything. These are all non-binding resolutions. They're just saying, hey, we should work on good things together. But here's the thing that we're missing so far in this discussion. What the United States said in their opposition is this treaty was not supposed to be about the internet in any way. We want no mention of the internet in here. This should be a telecommunications initiative. It should govern telecommunications, cell phone, landline, and that's it. And so any mention of the internet in this treaty could lead down the road to having the ITU possibly have some legitimacy in adding regulation later on. And they're putting their foot down and saying, no, we can have another conversation about the internet and maybe we'll agree to a lot of these things, but we don't want it now as part of this treaty. And so we will not ratify it.
And yet, a week prior, the ITU TAC-T, another working group of the ITU, ratified a recommendation for standardization of deep packet inspection globally. There's still alarming stuff going on here.
That's not part of this treaty, just so people don't get confused. It was a separate meeting, separate
right, but it's still the ITU.
And it was only saying, here's the standard. If you want to do deep packet inspection, everybody can agree to inspect their packets this way, which a lot of people say, well, there should not be any standard for that.
The other thing is, even if the U.S. did sign this, I mean, they would still need enacting legislation. So the fact that they wouldn't even bother to sign it and then do nothing with it says that's a pretty strong statement saying, yeah, we don't even want to be a part of this. We don't want to have our names on this because we're not going to cede any control whatsoever because we don't want this to be about the internet.
Well, the way that I feel about it is, the internet is just this really awesome thing that happens to be laid over top of these places that are in meat space that have like, all these traditional laws and whatnot. And the internet as a whole has been privatized since, January 1995. And since then has governed itself just fine. In fact, the United Nations even has a separate governance forum,
the IGF.
We think
that because we're the United States, Darren. But a lot of people do not think it's governed itself just fine. You may disagree with them. I disagree with them in a lot of cases about how it's not governed. But there is an issue where a lot of developing countries feel like they have needs, things as legitimate as access onto things as culturally significant to them as censorship of certain stuff, and that they're never addressed and they're not listened to.
Well, no, I feel like access is one thing, and that is definitely something that the Internet Governance Forum, which is actually an open organization that doesn't have closed-door meetings, that's part of industry that actually makes the Internet, you know, your Googles and your Facebooks and people like that. And that's one that is definitely a conversation that needs to be had and is being had. But I'm not so keen on the idea of, you know, governments who already censor the Internet and repress the Internet, like China and Russia, coming in and making recommendations to kind of, you know, basically justify their course of action within their own borders of the Internet so that other, nations could follow suit.
I think what happened here is that the ITU tried to pave the way in the smallest way for them to eventually be the place where people have that conversation. U.S., Canada, and a bunch of other countries said no. That this is not where we're doing this.
Exactly.
We're not bringing it into the United Nations. And so that's the upshot here.
Well, it is in the
United States will not sign the treaty. We've spent a little more time than I intended on this,
but it is a really
important topic because it is the future of the Internet. But the bottom line is nothing is going to change on the Internet anytime soon. But there are things going to change in Microsoft with Windows. Is that not true, Ayaz?
It might not. Actually, that might not be true at all. Because Microsoft's head of Windows product development, Julie Larson-Green, was talking to MIT's Technology Review. And they asked her flat out, you know, what's going to change now that she's in charge? And she said, not a whole lot. She led the introduction of the ribbon interface in Office. And right now she's the head of product development at Windows since Steven Sinofsky left those months ago. And on Windows 8's new interface, she says, quote, some people who review it for a shorter period of time may not feel how rich it really is. We're going for the overtime impression rather than the first 20 minutes out of the box. Microsoft found that people who used the old ways had a difficult transition to Windows 8, thought the tech press was going to face that first, that challenge. They're going to report that issue. And then she says it takes at least 2 days to 2 weeks to adjust. And with their customer experience improvement program, that Microsoft has found that desktop users, after 6 weeks, start using new things more than the things they were familiar with. It sounds like Microsoft's going all in with the Windows 8 interface. They think, like, okay, the longer we have it, the more people accept it. Shannon, you got your head in your hands. What's up?
I mean, shouldn't the whole point of having software and hardware be that when you pull it out of the box, you are happy with what you're doing, and it should be intuitive and it should be easy to use? It shouldn't take you 2 weeks to figure out how to erase the whole system and figure out where your settings are and stuff like that, which I have had problems with reviewing different products for before you buy that run Windows 8. Serious problems with those. So I completely disagree with her.
I totally get where she's coming from in that, you know, change is different and it's new and it's, oh no, scary because this is different. But at the same time, you know, change is inevitable. And if anything, the desktop experience is having its first change and first significant change in really a long time. So, you know, you should kind of embrace that because it's through that change that we'll get to something even greater. And there's always going to be growing pains. And I see what she's saying is that, hey, at first you sit down and like, wow, what just happened here? And I was just over at Rev3 talking to Patrick Norton. He got this new Lenovo thing that's got the Windows 8 and the touchscreen and all that. And I was like, do you find yourself actually reaching out and touching the screen because your brain is like, sees it and it's tangible and you just kind of go for it? Or is it kind of a distraction or a gimmick? And he said it was hard to tell because he's only had it for 2 days. But I wonder if she's right, if after, you know, having enough time with this, it just becomes second nature, just like, you know, sliding around a tablet feels second nature. And this isn't, you know, just Microsoft making big changes like that. I mean, Canonical made big changes like this with Unity and will probably continue to. So I think change is good.
I'm sure some people were thinking that with Sinofsky leaving that maybe there'd be some transition back to the older interface. It sounds like Microsoft's going to dig their heels in and say, this is all you need. You just need time. You'll get used to this. Tom, do you think that people will get used to this if Microsoft just keeps going, stay the course, as it were?
Microsoft does this all the time. They say, what we put out is just fine, and there's nothing wrong with it, because that's how they market. And then they go and they change everything later, and they say, oh, we now have a great way of doing it as well. They never admit that that the old way was bad, or they rarely do. And so this is the old style of Microsoft still pervading. Now, there is a new trend in Microsoft to be a little more open and be a little more responsive to the needs of users and the concerns of users. I think they're straddling that line here. And I think what they're saying is we really do like what we're doing here. And we really do believe that this is the best interface.
And I think Microsoft's thinking, look, you guys are the old guard. You guys are used to these things. That's the old style. You'll get used to the new style. The new generations will get used to that. Some of the chat rooms, like, look at a four-year-old touching a screen. They'll be able to access and understand this a lot easier than we will because we're so used to the old systems. But I think it's not – I don't know if it's meant for us older generations. It's meant for the newborns right now.
Yeah, exactly. If you're just starting out with Windows 8, then it's very intuitive. You see the different windows and the different screens, and you automatically think to touch them. But when you're coming from the older generations, when you're coming from having those advanced settings that you can get into with the older Windows 7 and XP and all those, even Vista, you lose that train of thought with Windows 8. Whenever you see the startup interface, you just get confused.
Or if you've been using computers for long enough, if you've had no problem going from DOS to DOS Shell to Win31 to Slackware to 95, the start menu, people hated that at first. And now people are like, bring my start menu back.
Yeah, exactly. Where's Program Manager? Why can't I get the Progman anymore?
Did they remove Progman?
Speaking of Microsoft, let's talk about Internet Explorer. Spider.io found an IE bug a few months ago. It's an exploit used through an ad that, as long as that ad is open on a page, and your browser doesn't have to be the active window, doesn't even have to be maximized, it will track where your mouse is going. They informed Microsoft of the issue on October 1st, but they said that Microsoft doesn't appear to be in a hurry to patch it. Microsoft yesterday blogged, well, from what we know, the underlying issue has more to do with competition between analytics companies than consumer safety or privacy, but we are actively working to adjust this behavior in IE. That's Dean Hachimovich, VP of Internet Explorer. Darren, how bad is this? Is this just analytics stuff that we could, you know, turn on ad blocker and forget about, or is this an actual exploit vulnerability?
Well, yeah, it's an actual exploit vulnerability in that, you know, like you said, any ad or any kind of like JavaScript that uses this fire event function can track not only your mouse movement, but also the use of control, alt, and shift keys, even if the browser is minimized. So in fact, with like iframes, you could, you know, potentially not even know that this is on a page. So, you know, I see the benefit for this for marketers, but I see the security implications, especially with things like soft keyboards, where you think you're secure on a public computer because you're not typing a password into the keys because there might be a keylogger, but rather a web page in the background or could be seeing, you know, even if they don't know exactly where the soft keyboard is, you can kind of still figure out the mapping based on the standard layout of a QWERTY keyboard. I think what this is a great example of responsible disclosure. Last time I was on the show, we were talking about anti-sec. This is an example of, in this case, Spider.io going to Microsoft and saying, hey, guys, October 6th, they said, like, look, you've got a bug here. You should fix this. And then Microsoft coming back and saying, well, we don't really have any intentions of fixing this. And so it's not until you bring this to the public. They, you know, released it on a bug track and I forget what mailing list it was, but anyway, this is it's now public, and you know, so they had 2 months to fix it, and Microsoft didn't, and so now Spider.io is saying, "Hey, look, we've even put together a game, and I tried the game out in Firefox. Doesn't work. You would think Firefox would support Fire Event. Guess not. Maybe that has more to do with competition between browsers than marketing agencies."
So what you're saying is Microsoft saying, well, this is no worse than cookies. Cookies track you, this tracks you, whatever. But we'll work on
cookies
it.
Cookies don't see you type in your
and
password.
And you're saying, okay, it's a little bit worse because it can track things like passwords.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel about it. And I don't want anybody knowing like where I'm clicking around. I don't, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so no script. Just install no script.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Done. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Squarespace gives you and your website users the best mobile experience. If you're thinking, oh, man, I've got this website, but I got to create a mobile version of it. If you move to Squarespace, you don't have to do anything. Just take your content. They import from all the current blogging systems. And then they have templates that are mobile ready. They're mobile responsive. That means your site automatically restructures to look great on any brand smartphone, tablet, or computer. When you add an image to your site, 7 different versions of that image are created so that the correct size loads for the screen that your website is showing on. And your site looks professional no matter what device people are using. And Squarespace is fast and easy to use. Beautiful templates, 100% drag and drop functionality for all the customization tools. New page builder tool called Layout Engine lets you customize pages in seconds. They automatically can pull photos from Instagram into your site, instantly sync pages and galleries to Facebook, auto-publish new blog entries on Twitter. You got to check it out. It's exceptionally well-designed and integrates all your website needs. But you don't have to take my buzzwords for it. Go get a free trial at squarespace.com. Sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card to do it. Just try it out. Start building your website. And if you decide to purchase it, use the offer code TNT12 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code TNT12. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank Squarespace for their continuing support of Tech News Today. All right, let's move on to Aereo, the broadcaster on the internet that takes over the air signals and brings them to you on the internet, finally getting a non-broadcast channel. What's up with this, IS?
Aereo picked up an official cable television partner. Now they were going to have Bloomberg on their service. Now, the Wall Street Journal says Aereo is actually going to pay Bloomberg, but the terms of the deal weren't disclosed. And like you were saying, Tom, Aereo gives users access to over-the-air signals, but they don't pay a dime to Fox, ABC, CBS, and the like. And they are currently being sued like crazy by these companies because they believe that Aereo should be paying them a cut, at least of the $12 fee that they charge per month. I guess, Tom, you and I, we're pretty into this whole cord-cutting thing. Is this deal with Bloomberg going to start a trend for more cable companies to join in? Or is this just going to infuriate broadcasters who are like, how come they're getting paid and we're not?
No, it's not going to infuriate the broadcasters because the broadcaster's already infuriated. It's not going to change anything on the broadcaster side of things. And this is business. This isn't emotional. Why Bloomberg is probably one of the first to do this is because Bloomberg is available in a lot of different places already. They stream their channel 24/7 online. They're available on the Roku already. They have carriage issues. They're not available on every cable system because companies like Fox, companies like NBC want to try to keep them out of competition. So Bloomberg's approach is like, well, if we can't bust into the mainstream, let's be everywhere else and ride the wave when internet television rises. So it really doesn't surprise me that Bloomberg is the channel that they start with. And it's not a bad thing for Aereo. It's not going to guarantee other cable companies will get on board, especially because most of the major cable companies are owned by the broadcasters that are suing Aereo. But you might see a few more independents look at this and say, oh, you know, if it made sense for Bloomberg, you know, maybe we'll talk to them too.
Shannon, do you think this makes this service more attractive to people who are thinking, okay, I got this antenna, I could do this $12 a month, or I could just go, I'll go to Aereo service, and they have extra channels?
I think it does make sense to me, and I really, really hope that it actually goes into different places other than just New York.
Now, Judge denied the request from the broadcasters to kind of like shut the service down. Last month, there was an appeals court where the court kind of compared Aereo to like tax dodging. So what I think, though, is that this, for as far as Aereo is concerned, this, like, you know, relationship with Bloomberg really kind of legitimizes their service more, and that the more that they can get these kind of deals, the stronger it makes them look in front of, you know, a jury or you know, some judges and whatnot. And I mean, to Bloomberg, you know, if you can't beat them, join them. The future of media is on the internet. So, you know, everywhere you can possibly get your channel, go ahead and do that. No?
I was gonna say, we might be biased because we're doing internet television right now. So it's kind of like, that's a full disclosure, we happen to be on the internet if you're watching this right now.
Oh, yes, we should probably disclose that just in case.
Yeah, you do have a good point, Darren, because a couple of months ago, I do remember Aereo was having a lot of legal issues. A lot of people were talking about them. They were in the news a ton. So, yeah, I can see Bloomberg TV bringing some legality to their whole service.
All right, let's move on to talk about Leap and Metro PCS launching a very T-Mobile-like program. What's up with that, IS?
Leap and Metro PCS are launching financing options for certain handsets. I believe it's over $200 for a handset. You can make a down payment, pay off the rest later. Metro PCS is working with Progressive Finance and BillFloat. Cricket is working with Progressive Finance. Now, Cricket was pretty talkative with Fierce Wireless, but Metro PCS kind of quiet. Cricket was explaining that its financing plan is slightly different from T-Mobile because T-Mobile requires you to have a two-year contract, and Cricket will not make you do that. Tyler Wallace, the senior vice president of marketing at Cricket, said Cricket's a prepaid carrier. You don't need a service contract, and Cricket's program doesn't require a credit check. What they're going to need, though, is access to a bank account. Metro PCS didn't give a ton of details because they have their own thing going. With this kind of financing plan, you know, now we're seeing these pretty major handsets like the iPhone 5 costing $105. Is this going to get people to move to prepaid wireless carriers since that sticker shock of a $500 phone is gone, Darren?
I hope so. And I hope that that enough people flood over to prepaid carriers that it makes the major carriers kind of change the way they do business. I'm not a fan of contracts. I feel like you save so much more money if you pay for the thing up front. If what we need is, people to go with kind of a financing plan to get there, then that's only a good thing for the industry.
I totally agree. I would love to go to a prepaid plan. The problem right now is the fact that I'm okay with a contract, mainly because I get the free phone whenever I sign up for it, or a much, much cheaper phone. But I always end up spending more than what I pay for. I only use like 256 megs per month, and I end up paying for, unlimited on AT&T. It's not very fair, and I would love for the major carriers to pay more attention to the prepaid plans on these other carriers and say, hey, maybe we should lower our prices.
Yeah, anything that's getting consumers in the mindset of actually owning the device and just going to any service provider they want is a good thing.
Tom, do you think this price, when you go to that store and you see the $100 instead of $549 or whatever these phones cost, do you think that's going to now make people go, wait a second, it's not just some carry with a ridiculous plan. It's those phones are affordable. We can go over there because they have the same coverage and they have what looks to be the same pricing, even though the structure is a little different.
That seems to be putting the cart before the horse to me. I mean, what I've noticed is that people want to get these prepaid phones, get prepaid plans, and they've seen the prices coming down on those. And so this is the carrier saying, well, let's figure out how to sell them more expensive phones instead of having them always getting the cheap phones because they want to go into prepaid. Let's figure out a better way to stop people from leaving these two-year contracts that are working less and less all the time. And it makes sense that you would see companies like Leap and Metro PCS, who sort of paved the way on prepaid, to figure out how to sell people more expensive phones. So, yeah, this makes perfect sense. That all you got to say, Mr. Akhtar?
That's all I got to say right now. Other than maybe I should speak better. Maybe I could learn English online. Is that possible, Tom?
That's the next story. I was just making sure you were done. Jane O'Brien has an article at BBC News Magazine about how the internet is changing language. Now, there are 4.5 billion pages on the web written in Chinese. Some linguists predict, though, that within 10 years, English will dominate the internet. I think I've always thought, well, English dominates the internet because the internet sort of started in the United States, and eventually that'll fade away and other languages will take up the charge, and English will have the percentage of the internet that it has of just people who speak English. But the point that the linguists make is that English has become the language of the internet because the internet started here in the United States, and it's the most common second language. There's lots of different forms of English. There's Hinglish, Spanglish, Konglish, and English is a bit of an aspirational language. It's identified with the movies and with the glamorous movie stars, and it's identified with Silicon Valley and with technology. So do you guys buy that? Shannon, do you think that the internet's language will actually become English more often than it is now?
I don't know if it will, but I really hope it does. See, I'm kind of obsessed with anime and like Sailor Moon and stuff like that. And whenever I go out and search for news about these different things from Japan, everything is written in, hiragana and katakana, and I can't understand it. So I have to trust that Google Chrome is going to translate everything correctly for me. So I would love to see everything on the internet's in English, but I know that wouldn't work out so well for, everyone in the world.
I think that the internet is developing its own pidgin and has been since the beginning. I mean, when you think about Leet Speak or more recently Lolcats, and like you said, these examples of these Englishes, so maybe it's English that is kind of like one of the most dominant things that's a little unifying here. But I'd be interested in seeing if in 100 years the internet has its own language.
Well, I mean, the thing about language communication in general is that it's about groups, right? That's how different dialects happen. The thing about the internet, since it connected everybody and there was the U.S. as a leader and we got English as our language. We got English. Look at me speak. We have English as our language. We have English as a predominant language. It's forcing the language to change much faster than I think we've ever seen it, because it's everywhere. You have to do a search term. You got to find out, can I use my keyboard? Do I have a special keyboard? How do I access these other things? So what's become default is moving towards English, but these dialects are happening because it's the world is just flat out smaller.
And like what I'm saying is like it's developing its own, you know, interesting individual characteristics. Like if I just put in a chat room the letter W, that's akin to LOL in Korean, at least.
It's a lot more
and Japanese, yeah. No, you're right. What this article got me thinking about and what it suggests, which is so interesting, is that English will become the language of the internet, but it won't be the English we are using right now. Mm-hmm. It will be an English created by the world on the internet. And so there'll be lots of slang, and this is not new. There's been pidgins, and there have been creoles, and all kinds of adaptations in local areas of English for a long time. The Story of English is a fantastic book that documents that and how flexible English has been at adapting to new cultures. But the internet is at once homogenizing sort of an internet version of English, but also localizing it in non-geographical ways. So if I'm – for instance, let's take Hinglish, right? Says somebody who speaks English and Hindi. That will become a culture on the internet that's spread around the world by people who speak that way. And then that will modify English. English will adapt to it, and it will become this new thing that we're going to sound like freaking Shakespeareans to people, I think, in 20 or 30 years. But the way we're talking now is just going to sound old and formal and weird.
I like what Zephyr said in the chat room. He said, death to the grammar police. Yeah.
There'll be a new
actually,
grammar
it's death
police.
To the king. We're murdering the king's English, and that's quite all right. Long live the king.
Well, when you made that mistake earlier, you're like, I speak English. Well, that's not even going to be an issue in the future. You'll just be like, well, this is my Ayaz.
No, I don't think I'm going to have my own dialect. I would rather go back to the things I've been trained to use. But the funny thing about English is that it keeps changing anyway. We stole languages like crazy. There's a ton of German, French, all kinds of languages already included into it. So to open it up, why not?
And underlying, the internet is all speaking the same language. 1-1-0-0-0-1. No? All right.
Well, you do have the right to assembly, Aaron.
Push.
Let's move on to the randomizer.
Randomizer.
Okay, Mashable, I've got a problem with your headline writer. Robot bartender takes to the skies was submitted on our Tech News Today subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. I clicked through and I thought, this is fantastic. A robot bartender on an airplane. I can't wait for this to come along. Well, it turns out the Skytender trolley is kind of cool, but it's really just a drink vending machine that can make more than 100 different types of beverages and mix up 15 different drinks.
Well, it got you to click, didn't it? I mean, that's the whole point. The headline,
it's such clickbait.
It's Friday. What do you think the headline's going to say?
There's nothing robotic about this.
Well, there's similar things like this. The drink dispensers over in Las Vegas, they have them all over the place. I mean, it's, I guess to have a robot is good so you're getting the same pour each time. But unless, I mean, it's got wheels. It just needs, you know, if they just put arms on the side of it, I think you'd be more accepting of it as a robot.
It's got wheels that have to be pushed by the flight attendants, exactly like the cart they have now.
It doesn't move by itself?
Yet.
No.
Yet.
Boo.
It's got a touch screen, and it takes all the drinks, and they are in those plastic bags so that they can just press a button and the Coke Zero comes out. Or they can press gin and tonic, and the gin and tonic will be automatically mixed and come out. And I think that's great, actually. I think this is pretty cool. It allows you to have hot and cold drinks, mixed it better. You don't have all those cans, all that waste. Like, I get it. It's a cool thing, but
so does
don't
it have,
promise me a robot when there's no robot.
Does it have any kind of, like, bumper control for turbulence?
Probably has locks on the wheels.
I want one of these.
Locks on the wheels, yeah.
You know, forget the airplane. I just want one of these at home. Are you kidding? Push a button and one of 15 different cocktails? Although I will say this would be so much better if they went, you know, a different angle with this, because who remembers the original bartending robot? I do. It was R2-D2.
That's right. Yeah. On the sail barge. Well done.
Yeah, that was a long, long time ago. In a galaxy far away.
You're right. It kind of was.
Stop living in the past.
And far away.
All right, let's go on to the calendar. iPhone 5 launching in China today. A lot of people saying that this is kind of a make or break moment for Apple. Talk about that stock price back in the news fuse. How the iPhone 5 does in China is going to be very significant to that stock price. Also, tomorrow, the the last day for the daily. The iPad newspaper shuts down. There will be no more issues. And also shutting down Verizon video service, fading to black. Its final screenings are tomorrow, December 15th, and likely, almost certainly, because they are moving to the Redbox Instant service, which is already launching in beta this month. And that's a look at the calendar. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got a voicemail from someone who thinks they have an idea why Microsoft expanded its Surface RT distribution.
AT&T crew, this is Kevin from Santa Rosa. Just having a thought regarding your discussion about the Windows RT tablet moving to places like Best Buy and Staples. I think that you just forgot one basic main point here, which is what if the OEM partners are a little hesitant to put out a device in the market today, a Windows RT device per se, in the market today, and they are waiting for Microsoft to see where they can go and achieve with their own testing the waters, as you may say. So just a thought. Thank you. Bye.
So the idea of Microsoft putting their own device out for Staples or putting it on Best Buy to encourage OEMs to manufacture RT devices because, hey, look, we're in the game. It's an interesting idea. I don't know if it was the OEM's idea or Microsoft's.
Yeah,
idea.
I was about to say, is this a carrot or is this a stick from Microsoft to the OEMs?
It's hard to tell.
It's a stick made out of a carrot.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, I think he's probably right, but I also think that was the plan all the time was to have the RT be the test. So the test may not be going as well if he's right. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Maybe. I
mean, in other words, the test was, hey, we got the RT. We're going to sell it in Microsoft stores and online, and then you guys can make your own. And fewer people made them. So they're like, okay, well, we'll put it into retail stores so you can see how it sells there.
Well, that just makes sense. I mean, I can't think of the closest Microsoft store to me.
Yeah.
Is there one?
Mine's in Corte Madera, or was in Corte Madera. Actually, I don't know where. I think there might be one in the Santa Monica Boulevard,
in your
something
kitchen.
Or other.
It's in his kitchen. Yeah, it's in the microwave somewhere.
It probably is.
Nuke it.
Let's move on to an email.
Sure. We got a message from Rob from Toronto. He says, hey, TNT team, I think that the NBC-Yahoo partnership makes sense from a second screen experience point of view, given the excellence of Yahoo Sports properties like their fantasy leagues. Imagine watching Sportball on Sunday. NBC Sports is live on the big screen, and your iPad is showing the real-time status of your Yahoo Fantasy Sportball League, along with the gloating comments from your friends, player statistics in sync with the color commentary, and then an amazing replay from a game that you aren't watching pops up. Sports fans would kill for that experience.
Well, this would be great for the fantasy sport people. I don't even know how that stuff works, but I know there's like fantasy football leagues and things like that.
I mean, doesn't that take all the fun away, though, if they integrate the fantasy sports with the live sports so you don't have to get your dungeon maps out and do your charts?
I get all my second screen stuff for sports from the actual league, right? If I'm watching a baseball game, I've got the MLB app, Major League Baseball app, open, and I'm looking at that. I guess with fantasy, it would be nice if we use CBSSports.com for our fantasy baseball league, if they had a really cool app that was integrated with MLB. But most of the good information comes right from the leagues anyway. I mean, they control all that stuff. So I'm not sure how successful this might be, I guess.
Maybe they could add like a remote control app, a whole different thing, so that when you want to see your game, like, hey, my player's right now, change the channel. Although it's got to be NBC all the time because this is the NBC deal.
This reminds me of AOL Time Warner and MSNBC so much. So I think it's just reinforcing the eternal return.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Speaking of eternal return, I'll be back in Petaluma on Monday, and so will Sarah Lane. But that's it for this episode of Tech News Today. Thank you, as always, Darren Kitchen. Tell folks what's happening on Hack 5 this week.
Oh, we are brute-forcing Android phones with a USB rubber ducky. We're taking down those four-digit PIN codes in just under 16 hours at hack5.org. And also our new show, ThreatWire, at youtube.com/ThreatWire, I think. And that's all about preserving your internet freedom and your privacy and security.
Now, Shannon Morris is on those shows as well. But, Shannon, you also are producing Before You Buy right here at Twit.
Yes, I am. And this week we have plenty of really cool gadgets. We have one that's really interesting, a HUD device that you can wear while you go skiing. So it shows you all sorts of cool information about your heart pulse and all sorts of neat stuff. So
ooh, like
can't
Archer.
Wait to check that out.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, that's it, folks. You can find a way to submit stories for our consideration. If you're like, why didn't you cover this? Go to our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. That's the place where you can put things up for consideration, and the rest of the audience has a chance to vote on them as well. And we look at that. That's where we got our randomizer with the robot bartender in the sky today. So check it out, technewstoday.reddit.com. Big thanks to all the moderators in there that keep it clean, keep it working. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is TNT@twit.tv. And you can give us a call, leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. Scott Johnson joins us on Monday. We'll see you then.